The following edited podcast has been declassified by the Banzai Institute for Biomedical Engineering and Strategic Information.
All Hong Kong Cavaliers, Blue Blazer Regulars, Radar Rangers, and Rug Suckers to 5 Minutes of Banzai, the only podcast on the internet that discusses the W.D. Richter cult classic, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, 5 Minutes at a Time. I'm Josh Horowitz from the Wing Kong Exchange and the 5 Minutes of Trouble podcast, and my co-host is the duck hunter notable for shooting down alien spacecraft near Grover's Mill, New Jersey, Brett Stillo.
And I'm cute, too. Hi, Josh. How are you?
Hello. Doing okay.
It seems like it's been years since we've done a podcast together.
Years. It seems like it, but...
There has been a bit of a gap that we're now getting back on track to give you the finest we can offer you in
the finest free in listening entertainment. Yes.
Yes.
And we're going to begin this new chapter in Great Listening Entertainment with a great guest who is here from the Better Off Dead Minute. I present Curtis Blaze. Welcome, Curtis, to 5 Minutes of Banzai.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for having me. I love the show.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Actually, I first got in touch with Curtis through the bunkhouse. He was actually one of the first people to contact me once we got... things up on Facebook, and he mentioned he was a big fan of the film and wanted to be on, and so here you are, Curtis.
Oh, man, I love the opportunity to be on the show, especially alongside the caliber of guests you've had. I'm not worthy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have had some great guests, and now you are part of the Hall of Fame of guests on this show.
You know, we look after the fellow Blue Blazer regulars.
Yeah, especially since your last name is Blaze. I mean, you can't get any better than that.
Nice.
Nice. So, Curtis, tell us, how did you discover this fine motion picture? What's your introduction to it? Tell us your story.
I was a lonely, nerdy child who watched movies that nobody else liked on purpose just to see what I was missing, and came across this one. I actually think my first experience with it was through the Marvel Super Special comic book.
Oh, the comic book. That's interesting.
I still have it to this day.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in a small town. My parents never let me go to the movies. So that was how I experienced a lot of movies, was through Marvel. Or all the good ones, anyway.
Yeah, that two-part Marvel series about the film. I have it somewhere. I remember buying it on eBay years ago, and I've been searching for it for the last couple of months. One day it will turn up. But that's great. So you read the comic and then you saw the film. So what did you think of the film after you had read the comic?
Well, I loved the movie. It wasn't quite the same as the comic. The comic had the extended edition beginning that wasn't released until when? 2005 as the movie on the DVD.
Ah, so that would be the prologue with Buckaroo's parents.
Yeah, the comic had the prologue all along. So when I watched the movie for the first time, that was missing for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't know the prologue was ever added back on until I agreed to be a guest on the show and got to see that finally for the first time.
Oh, wow. So you really hadn't seen it before. Yeah.
No.
It does add an extra, I think, needed bit of backstory. Somehow that Star Wars crawl at the beginning doesn't quite give the film as much, I don't know, gravitas that you get from seeing Buckaroo's parents die.
Right.
Maybe. Plus, it's you know, that sequence is so well done, you know, with the home movie effect and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
You guys have probably covered this, but that was Jamie Lee Curtis?
Yes, it was. Yeah, as the story goes, she was dating, apparently, somebody who was part of the crew and just sort of asked to be in it, and there she was. So serendipity, sometimes you get these parts.
Meanwhile, we have 5 minutes to cover today.
Yes, we do. We are actually covering minutes 40 through 45 in this episode, and minute 40 starts with two hunters who are shining a flashlight at something stuck in a tree, and they end with Blue Blaze regular Scooter Lindley receiving Perfect Tommy's radio call for help. This section actually starts with the Hunter section, so we're kind of still in TV movie land.
Yep.
As far as I can tell.
The continuing adventures of Bert and Bubba.
Yes, Bert Burton.
Bert
as Burton. We've defined him before. Yes.
If this movie had been a smashing success, a huge box office triumph, would you think we might have gotten, I mean, the downside could have been more Bert and Bubba? There might have been a spinoff show.
I would have liked to see that. I mean, Bert's kind of this super bossy sort of jerk, and Bubba's kind of this wimp. We've got a pretty good duo going on there with a lot of possibility. Bert could be like this divorced, bitter old man who, I don't know, probably works with Bubba at the plant. They're kind of friends, but maybe they've been friends from high school, but Bubba's just really kind of this married guy who just wants to be at home, but he's kind of lonely for a platonic male friend thing. Maybe these two have been friends since high school, and I don't know. I sense Bubba isn't really into the friendship. But Bert kind of really likes Bubba. But he's probably too insecure to express that, and so that's why he's kind of abusive to him. Maybe he's resentful because he's like sensing that Bubba is withdrawing emotionally from him as time goes on.
Wow. We're actually setting up the whole backstory right now for that long-expected spin-off movie.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure right Bert's there. Wife has died. And so he's like this bitter widower.
That's why he's so uptight.
Yeah.
That's why he's so focused on finding out what's in that tree. Because there are so many answers he doesn't have. So many questions he doesn't have an answer for. And there's so many answers he doesn't have a question for because he's Bert.
Well, I kind of like the thought that we had from the last episode when Justin Coote was mentioning that maybe this whole sequence with these weekend warriors who seem to be very clueless, and they come up on the aliens, it's kind of an homage to these 1950s kind of cheesy sci-fi movies. I think that that's probably what was being shot for here. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I'd agree. Watching it a few times, War of the Worlds from 1953 comes up or comes to mind.
I do have a couple of little notes about the two actors who played Bert and Bubba. So they're played by actors Kenneth McGee and James Keen. McGee is playing Bert. He's the hunter with the mustache. He was a working actor in both TV and film who got to work again with John Lithgow in an episode of Third Rock from the Sun. This was before McGee passed away in 2015. Working actor, did a lot of TV stuff. And then James Keen plays Bubba. He's the hunter who has the two shotguns. And another working actor on TV and film. He had roles in Apocalypse Now, Close Encounters, and Dick Tracy.
Really?
What did he do in Apocalypse Now?
I have no idea. It was probably not a big role. I just remember coming across that.
You know, these two really give me a Taggart and Billy vibe from Beverly Hills Cop.
Oh, yeah, totally. Totally. In fact, I'm trying to remember the actor who plays Taggart, because Bert sort of looks like the D-movie version of that guy.
Taggart is John Ashton.
That's right, John Ashton.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you couldn't get John Ashton, you got this guy.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we're looking for a younger, more aggressive Wilford Brimley. Who do you got?
Well, I got this guy with a mustache. That's as close as we're going to get, right?
Yeah. I'd like to think that he worked exclusively with an agent who represented older guys with mustaches. And if you would go to this agent's office, you'd see just headshot after headshot of kind of jowly guys with big bushy mustaches. And
you got your Sam Elliott in there.
Oh, your Sam Elliott, your Lee Horsley. Yeah, Burt Reynolds. But that is quite a stash on Burt. There's one thing, and only one thing, I really like about Burt and Bubba.
What's that?
Their frog skin camo.
Ah.
That is some classic old school duck hunter camouflage that they're wearing. That's an interesting pattern, that splotchy pattern. You think of, like, you know, on your, you know, on a G.I. Joe uniform. That's called frog skin, and it goes back to World War II. And it was designed for the United States Marine Corps. by an artist, staff artist of the San Francisco Chronicle.
Oh,
and,
San Francisco.
San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I was born there. no, I wasn't, but nice. I like doing Takei. But yeah, you know, you don't see on hunting gear, you know, you don't see that old school splotchy jungle camo anymore. You see, nowadays, you know, you see that.
Well, they got the bright red or bright orange, probably yeah. because there were too many people wearing those frog skins and they yeah. got shot.
Kapow.
So here's two instances in this film where we see kind of like pre safety requirements. Buckaroo not wearing a helmet and the hunters not wearing orange vests.
Very dangerous movie. Very dangerous movie. But yeah, I tire of Bert and Bubba and their Saturday morning antics, but I do like their camo. Because mm-hmm. To me, it's a throwback, and it's not that modern poopy brown Bass Pro Shop Jackson Pollock 12 gauge camo crap. So this is good camo. Good camo.
Good camo. Well, Curtis, what do you think about this portion of the film when we get to these hunters in this whole section?
I agree totally that this is right out of the Incredible Hulk TV show.
Incredible Hulk. Nice.
Especially when they do the gun throwing gag.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's so A-Team.
Yeah. A-Team or Dukes of Hazzard.
That is Dukes of Hazzard. That is yeah. Enos. Yeah. That would be Roscoe asking Enos to throw him the gun. And that's precisely what would happen.
There's quite a bit of Sheriff Roscoe. I'll say this, like throwing the rifle, that is a good gag, but it just doesn't work in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's just these guys and their shtick, it's out of place. You know, like you said, Dukes of Hazzard, outtakes from Caddyshack or something like that. It's just not this movie. Not when you have guys quoting lines like, no matter where you go, there you are.
Yeah.
And laugh while you can, monkey boy. So sorry, Bert. Sorry, Bubba. No sequel for you.
It is kind of an awkward scene compared to the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You have sort of a hipper than thou screenplay and cast, and everybody's cool and basically wearing club clothes from the 80s and latest electronics, and then you have these guys.
Yeah. It must be the homage to the 50s. That's the only way that I can sort of wrap my head around it and still, you know,
yeah.
like the movie as much.
I could also imagine Earl MacRouch probably grew up with a lot of Berts and Bubbas.
Mm.
You know, I believe he grew up in West Texas wearing frogskin camo, was dressing up.
Mm.
Well, that brings up something I was wondering about. What do we have a Bubba doing in New Jersey? I mean,
Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Isn't this where it is?
Is that southern New Jersey?
Well, actually, you know, Princeton University traditionally was the Ivy League school where Southerners went to. So it's possible. I don't think Bubba went to Princeton, but he could have worked for a guy who went to Princeton, who was, say, from Virginia or North Carolina. So that's my answer for Bubba. He moved. He got a job at a shotgun rifle cleaning factory.
We might as well get to that point here. After they touch the trees and the sparks fly, then yes, we do get that scene, which very much is evocative of the boulder scene with that rolling thermopod. If anything, though, it reminded me of the scene in Austin Powers with the steamroller,
yeah,
where you know he's kind of screaming and it's like slowly coming to you. You know, you can't of course run in opposite directions. Yeah. You know, unless, is it perpendicular? Yeah. No, I mean it's got to come to you.
Real thermopods roll faster than that. That's really an insult to the design and construction of a thermopod.
Is it a thermopod knockoff then?
Total thermopod knockoff. A real thermopod would just zoom, be gone. Those guys would have been flattened.
So it's not like a Toyota version, it's like a Hyundai version?
Maybe thermopod is the brand name.
Yep, yes. That's what we were speculating in the last episode.
Oh my God.
Maybe that's
okay.
The brand.
Yes, it's not a space pod. It's a thermopod.
Really, it's just the facial tissue of thermopods. It's not the actual Kleenex.
But and yeah, like you said at the beginning, Josh, this whole sequence has a rushed feeling to it, kind of TV movie. Mm-hmm. You've got just real basic night photography here. I'm guessing this is maybe Fred Kohnkamp is now the full-time director of photography here at this point. Mm-hmm. It's very, you know, let's just get that thermopod and the hunters in a wide shot. Let's just shoot it wide, and then we can all break for dinner.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, very much could be.
The marks on the pod in the comic book, the only mark that's on there is the red one. And I get the impression from, well, it's been over 30 years, but I've always had the impression that the red streak was from them shooting the pod earlier, and that was blood running down the side. Maybe not running down the side, but, you know, smearing down the side as it rolled.
Oh, wow.
On this viewing, though, I noticed there was also a yellow smear. So it brings up questions for me. Are the pods alive?
Are they organic? We speculated a little bit about that in other episodes.
Yeah.
I'm jumping ahead 3 seconds here, but it's kind of got a mouth.
Yeah, it kind of does. We do see that later. Yeah, it almost looks like this sort of gaping mouth when John Baluk gets up out of there. I don't know. It's all kind of been designed to resemble kind of sea life and coral and sea creatures. But is it organic? Brett, what do you think?
I had never thought of it until this very moment, but I think you're on to something there.
Well, yeah, it's got kind of a red, glowy interior.
Yeah. Mm. And the fact that, you know, in a previous scene when Bert and Bubba shoot it, it screams.
Well, and in this scene, when it finishes rolling and sparks, it makes like a dog whine. It's like, roar!
Yeah. So, I think the Electroids have some kind of a bioengineering. We don't build thermopods, we grow them. On a big thermopod farm outside of Planet 10. I'm picturing that commercial now.
Well, maybe they need heat to grow. They come out of pods, thus...
And they call them pods. Thermopods. Yeah.
The thing that does emerge from that thermopod moving forward is, yes, our first glimpse at a black Electroid, who's human-looking. He's got that weird sort of goggle-like scanning apparatus. And according to the script, his name is John Baluk. Actually, he does get named this by the other alien inside named John Gant. And he wears this loud paisley suit and pink striped tie.
Which he borrowed from Jack Burton.
Right, from Henry Swanson.
Yeah, it's his Henry Swanson suit.
It is the Henry Swanson suit. That's what was so familiar to me about it. Oh my God, you're totally right. Does he have the glasses?
No, he doesn't have the glasses, but that can only be one suit, and that is Henry Swanson's suit. Now, Jack Burton got the suit, I think it has to do with the New Jersey State Trooper, and I don't know.
Well, you know that if John Baluk had a chance to actually speak, maybe he would have said, you know, it's raining cats and dogs out here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hey, just officially, is this the same world as Trouble?
I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
It does have that relationship via W.D. Richter, but different writers of the screenplay.
Boy, it sure seems to have the same... It sure seems to exist in the same world.
It is a good fit, or it would be a good fit. And, you know, we've speculated that perhaps Jack had a job driving World Watch 1 at one point. Or I'd like to think, you know, that truck the motorcycles were on, maybe Jack was driving that.
Right, the Harley Davidson hat that Jack Burton wears.
There
coincidence?
You go. No. No, it's got to be. It's all in the same universe. No.
Have you guys read the script out there that's floating around for Versus the Crime League, the World Crime League?
Yeah, that's the one, yeah, by Ernest Cline. And in that one, Jack Burton is one of the Blue Blazer regulars and takes Buckaroo on the Pork Chop Express. So at the very least, Ernest Cline wanted there to be a relationship. It does make sense. But moving forward, yes, we get that throw the gun gag, and we get that weird sort of ship... you know, the entrance kind of closes up like a mouth with jaws. I mean, we were just on the Thing Minute not too long ago, and I kind of thought of that.
Yeah,
just the scene where the guy's chest opens up. It kind of reminded me of that.
It is kind of that. Oh, and then to crap on our earlier point, as Baluk comes up out of the thing, Lando Calrissian mm-hmm. style,
yes.
there's a mechanical noise, like a ding.
Yeah, it does that, feel like that.
That goes along with him sort of stopping, like a platform has been, you know, lifting him up.
Yeah, it could be. But it's just bizarre how he it causes him to lose his balance. And it's just weird how he loses his balance silently. I mean, here would be a perfect place for a Wilhelm scream, I think. and then he hits his head on the rock. Could have been done a little bit better. This kind of feels just like that scene in the previous minutes when Buckaroo collides with the Yoyodyne van. I mean, it's, you know, the editing is there, but it just doesn't feel as convincing as it could be.
Oh, no, it's not convincing at all. The mouth closes. He's not anywhere near the mouth when it closes. I guess we're calling it a mouth. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
Hatch, whatever it is, it doesn't shake the ship. There's no visible reason for him to fall other than that he got freaked out by the thing closing and it made him forget where he was and he took a bad step or something, except mm-hmm. that his feet remain planted solidly on top of the thing and he just kind of rolls off.
Okay, let's just get it out there. I mean, he's a martyred Lectroid hero, and nobody wants to say it, but he had an electricity problem. He was hitting the batteries. Nobody wants to say it about John Baruch, you know? I mean, back on Planet 10, there are folk songs. He fell on his head, you know? There's the movie, he fell on his head, you know? He's a big-time hero, and nobody wants to say he was an electricity abuser. He had little Ever-Ready 9 volts in his pockets. He was juiced when he came out of that spaceship. Absolutely juiced.
Well, you do hear the static electricity sounds when he clunks his head, so maybe that's you know, the remnants of too much.
I've got questions about that.
Okay.
Is that him... Okay, first of all, I want to say that I didn't realize they drank electricity until I listened to your show last Tuesday. That just never occurred to me that that's what was going on. So, good spot there. Did I mention that I love your show? And then, next, is the sound of the electricity him discharging onto the rock, or is it his disguise malfunctioning?
Hmm. Yeah.
Is it electricity keeping? Because electricity... Wait, okay, this is a little weird. Banzai... No, Buckaroo is ionized.
Right.
And in this context, that means he's electrified? What does ionized mean exactly?
It means that he has a lot of, like, more electrons than protons, I guess, okay. in his system.
Okay, so...
So he has a negative charge, an overall negative charge.
So this negative charge allows him to see through these disguises that the Lectroids have.
Possibly. It's either that or some, I don't know, some like magical zap thing that they gave to him as part of that phone call from the president.
I would imagine, you know, he talks about this in later minutes, but I'm imagining that the Lectroids give off an electromagnetic current, a field
mm-hmm.
that affects perhaps something in our brains. You get a chemical reaction. And so, you know, we look at an Lectroid and we say, hey, that guy looks like a character actor on a TV show. Couldn't possibly be an alien. So therefore, when this guy basically falls on his head and short circuits... then perhaps that electromagnetic field slowly dissipates. As, you know, you hear Bert and Bubba say, as we see an ominous pink box being mm-hmm. lowered in the foreground.
Yes.
Look, he's changing. But but this brings up my question. What the hell does electricity smell like?
Hmm.
That line has always boggled me. It smells like electricity. Yeah, no, it smells like teen spirit.
Maybe it smells like ozone?
Yeah, I was thinking ozone. That's what I've always assumed.
Okay.
If you go to Sharper Image and you get some of those, those ionizer things that are supposed to, clear out the air, sometimes they have like a little bit of a smell that comes from it. So maybe that's the smell of electricity.
Okay.
Did you just say you can buy an ionizer?
Yeah, you don't have to be zapped like Buckaroo. You can go to Sharper Image.
Are you able to touch your loved ones without bringing them back to life after being around one of these things?
Well, here's where we see technology provided by the Bonsai Institute.
Oh, that's right.
And is filtered out into the public and, I mean, cell phones. We wouldn't be able to talk on cell phones if it wasn't for Buckaroo and the Hong Kong Cavaliers and their Go phones.
The Go phones, right.
Yeah. But wait a minute. Go phones. Am I seeing that right? Are those Swiss Army knives with antennas?
Well, probably.
They're proto-Nokias, those small phones, right?
I swear there's a bottle opener on the side, a corkscrew.
Yeah, probably. There's the unsung hero in this production is that Richter has mentioned before is Eric Nelson, the prop guy who would apparently just, whip up the craziest looking stuff out of nothing. I would imagine some of the things we see, like the Go phone, which, that probably is a corkscrew with an antenna coming out of it.
It actually reminded me, just talking about this, I was reading the novel recently, and they talk about in the novel, and this was written, 83 or something like that, about the miracles of cellular technology, and that's how they're able to talk to one another via these Go phones. So somebody had a glimpse of the future, even back then.
As the parent of a fourth grader, we just got our son just a regular cell phone, but there are these, buy it by the minute sort of phones that exist out there. And one of the brand names is GoPhone.
Wow.
The deuce, you say.
Exactly.
Nice. But moving along a little bit, the transformation happens. At least we're told of the description of it. Saves a lot of budget. There seem to be a lot of sort of radio drama descriptions during this whole section.
Very much so. Very much so. That's one thing. I think this might have been an homage to, or homage, to Orson Welles and War of the Worlds.
Yes.
And all those 30s horror sci-fi melodramas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, aren't they almost, if not exactly, very much in spirit quoting the sort of farmer that finds the aliens first in War of the Worlds, or the reporter, as he describes the things emerging from the, holes?
Oh, quite
from
possibly.
The craters?
Are you talking about the movie from 1953 or the Orson Welles radio show?
The radio show.
Gosh, that's a really good point. It's been a long time since I've heard that radio broadcast, but
I think they are. Show,
they, it's, I it's wonder if very... they called them purple dinosaurs.
Wait, Barney?
Yes, a strange, a very strange premonition of.
Is this yet another thing the Bonsai Institute has given the world?
What, Barney?
Barney?
No.
Well, I think Buckaroo would be the first to point out all the benefits, all the great things Barney has done for children over the years. And now he really has been a major figure in education. Look at the modern millennial. We have Barney to thank for that.
Wow.
Hey, I've got a question about John Parker. Mm-hmm. Is he coming out of the same sort of mouth thingy that John Belushi came out of?
It would have to be, I think.
Right?
I don't see another opening anywhere.
So, was the pod... that's just weird. Was the pod... Did the pod not like John Belushi?
Hmm.
Because he seemed to be pretty freaked out when that mouth closed. He was like, hey!
Unless it started to close because John Parker wanted to come back up. I don't know. Maybe there was an effect there.
I've told you my reasons, and I'm not going to go back and say it again, but I think it's obvious we had someone who shouldn't have been on the mission in the first place.
Yeah.
He should have been in electroid rehab, but, you know, yeah, there probably was another hatch on, like, surface level that he could have just walked out of, but no, he had to go through the top hatch with all the Venus flytrap teeth. I don't know.
Well, I do like the idea that somewhere on planet 10, there's actually a large statue of John Baluk, and then it just has an engraving at the bottom. It says, he fell on his head.
I want to go there. I want a Polaroid moment there.
Nice. Well, moving along, after we see the dead John Baluk with his black electroid appearance, it turns out he has something very special in his possession. Smeared in mud, we find a 60-cent copy of a Marvel comic, Buckaroo Banzai. And it's the latest issue, but it's issue number one.
Right, I was going to say the same thing.
But I have a little bit of information about that comic that we see there. Again, thanks to our friends over at Figment Fly and the Buckaroo Banzai FAQ, I've learned that the comic book cover was drawn by illustrator Michael Kaluta, who's known for doing covers for comics such as The Shadow during the, I guess, late 70s, early 80s. And the neat thing about the comic is that it depicts what might be the film's only visual depiction of Hanoi Shan. We see that on the cover there.
Looking very kind of Ming the Merciless there, but yeah, that's that's Hanoi Shan, and it's and a mysterious female who seems to be hanging out with Hanoi Shan.
Yes, who could it be?
God, I want to see the sequel to this movie so bad. Do we know? Is there a canon source that says what date this is taking place on?
I don't remember seeing anything in the novel specifically. I mean, of course, they talk about October 31st, 1938. Which was right. When War of the Worlds was broadcast. Is also this, was that also supposed to be the exact same date when the Hakita-Lizardo experiment happens?
You know, I do believe that the ill-fated Hakita-Lizardo experiment occurs shortly, sometime before War of the Worlds, because I think it has been established, you know, through backstories and various drafts that Lizardo escapes. He does bad things. He gets some money together. He's able to get more electroids through. And that, you know, that there's that first attempt to take over the Earth and open the eighth dimension. And at some point, yeah, they get Orson Welles involved. They write him a bad check or something like that. But yeah, we can assume that Lizardo needed some time to rally his forces that eventually became Yoyodyne.
We get to move back to Buckaroo now. We've finally gotten past the hunters, and we're at Buckaroo Banzai, and it's nighttime, and he's soaked.
Soaked, and he has particles all over him.
Yes. Now, my question is, was he knocked out as a result of that close call with the motorcycle, and he just woke up now? Because it's dark now. I mean, it's been hours.
Well, I say, yeah. He's got dirt all over him. He's soaked.
I never thought of that. I always thought he was all just sweaty from working on the motorcycle.
Oh, you think maybe he worked on the motorcycle the whole time?
Yeah. But yeah, how did he get jets? But, you know, yeah, he would have called. He should have called Rawhide much sooner.
Yeah.
But, hey, no script is perfect.
It wouldn't be inconsistent in the 80s for someone who owns a Harley to have to work on their bike for about 3 hours for every 1 hour of driving.
Exactly. It was a whole different motorcycle back then. They probably begged to be in the movie.
The guys I knew that actually owned them back in that time used to bring them into their house every winter and take them completely apart, clean them out completely, and then put them all back together nice and tight so that it would last the entire, you know, riding season again. Without falling apart.
But Buckaroo pulls out that little red communicator of his that has the antenna, and we get our communication with Rawhide. I like Rawhide's line where he says, "Where in Hades are you?" Again, very comic book lines.
Very comic booky. In a moment, Buckaroo says one of my favorite lines, and that's, "The deuce, you say?"
Yeah.
And that's straight out of a Penny Dreadful. I think the first book that line was used in was The Count of Monte Cristo.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The background of the Deuce, you say, is, yeah, there was a time hundreds of years ago in Christian Europe when you could get in trouble for saying the devil, you say.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a code word. That was just a substitute because it might be considered uncouth, rude. Mm-hmm. You might get a 17th century oscillation overthruster. Cover, you know, censoring when you say the you say. So it became the deuce you say.
Ah.
Probably kept you from getting burned at the stake or having your eyeballs poked out with hot sticks or something like that. But, you know, it's a very antiquated, you know, I think that that's a line Conan Doyle would use in a Sherlock Holmes book. But there's, you know, it's definitely one of my favorite lines in the movie. And mm-hmm. it's the way Weller reads it. It's very casual. I mean, yeah. he almost looks like he might be stoned when he says it. Oh, the deuce you say.
Well, he's not stoned. He's ionized.
He's ionized. Maybe that's, and maybe that's why he appears to be sweaty or wet. I mean, I've never been ionized by an alien from another dimension, so it might really mess with your metabolism.
Yeah. Well, it seems to cause static, apparently, when he's talking over his phone device. And another thing I kind of noted moving forward from here, when Rawhide walks away after saying Yo-Yodyne, look at the poster behind him. So I like how it says Harley Davidson, Eastern Division Dealer of the Year, John something. So, coincidence?
Oh, no, no.
Our first mention of John's?
Yeah. Small berries. Yeah, it'll just... Small berries.
Wow, we're back at the forest again. And this is the part now where the patrolman drags that body, covers it, but here comes the Yo-Yodyne van. And that scene with the bright lights on the darkness. So I was wondering just here, I mean, is this Cronenweth or Conan Camp who's filming this? Just because it kind of has that feel of, you know, almost like something out of, well, I kind of mentioned it was almost something like out of Blade Runner, because we do see one of the guys come out, John O'Connor, and he's got this kind of big trench coat and there's these backlights going on. He kind of looks like Deckard. I don't know.
Yeah.
Who was it?
No. That's interesting. You say Blade Runner. My first thought was The Thing.
Mm.
And just, you know, all the natural light that's used to illuminate the scene. Yeah, just amazing backlighting. And, you know, I'm going to say Conan Camp because while we sure do like Cronenworth, you know, Conan Camp had some great credits. I mean, he wasn't like this schlocky, you know, discount DP. He was the director of photography on Patton.
Patton!
Patton! I mean, Patton! And, you know, as long as we're on the subject of Mr. Conan Camp, you know, a movie we haven't mentioned yet that kind of an interesting movie, that would be the film adaptation of Doc Savage from 1975.
Ah, yes.
Not a very good movie.
Mm-hmm.
One thing is you've got Fred Conan Camp, who was the director of photography on that. He had some nice moments in it here and there. In what was largely a misconceived movie, the last movie by the great George Pal, who produced War of the Worlds in 1953. Oh, it all comes together. I'm going to start talking like New Jersey now. Oh, don't you get it? George Pal produces War of the Worlds, but
but Doc Savage though is a you know, very very much like Buckaroo Banzai or vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. We haven't. I don't think we've talked about that enough. And and it's funny, Josh. I mean, as much as I love this movie, I don't think I ever really really put it together that oh yeah, Buckaroo Banzai is this hip, you know, postmodern. Doc Savage. I mean, it's the same deal. It's like super genius guy with 27 different degrees, and he's got a bunch of buddies who follow him around, and they have adventures.
Yeah. Curtis, are you familiar with Doc Savage at all?
I'm not.
Yeah, I knew it as a comic book, but apparently it was a pulp novel before it was even that. And he was sort of considered one of the first sort of superheroes without powers, but just a really versatile sort of Renaissance person who was also buff. He was a scientist, and he had his group of pals, really, who would go on adventures with him. It very much does feel like Buckaroo Banzai.
Yeah. Doc Savage is interesting because he's largely forgotten today. Although I think I'd read recently that Shane Black, I think, is trying to do an adaptation of Doc Savage. And of course, The Rock is involved because The Rock is involved in everything. But Doc Savage is interesting because of his influence in a lot of other characters. And yeah, he was never a comic book character directly, but his pulp adventures influenced comic writers. Siegel and Schuster with Superman ripped off Doc Savage, because Doc Savage has an Arctic compound, a retreat called, get this, the Fortress of Solitude.
Uh-huh. Nothing is sacred.
They were just kids. They were just trying to meet a deadline, but they didn't even try. Hey, let's give Superman a Fortress of Solitude. Everyone's getting them these days.
Well, as long as you guys brought up the organization, what exactly is the hierarchy of the Buckaroo Banzai organization? Is he, like, how's it all work?
Okay, so as far as I can tell, and correct me if I'm wrong, Brett.
Oh, I will.
So Buckaroo is the leader. He's the head of the Banzai Institute, along with, I guess, Hakita. You know, these are the people on top. And then he has his right-hand man, who is Rawhide. And anybody who basically plays in his band and is sort of the close compatriots, those are the Hong Kong Cavaliers. They are all members of Team Banzai. And the Blue Blazer Regulars...
Are they all department heads?
I don't know if it's departmentalized, so to speak. What do you think, Brett?
You know, I don't think they ever got into it that much, but there's probably, director of oceanography or something like that.
Yodine has that, though, because we do hear John Big Boutte say that he's director of operations over at Yodine. But as far as I know, they don't have that in the Banzai Institute. They do have the Blue Blazer Regulars. Those are the ones who are, I guess that's supposed to be a takeoff of the Baker Street Irregulars, if you talk about...
Right.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes. You know, just people who help out, but they're not kind of affiliated directly.
And it's never stated, but there does appear to be a hierarchy among Blue Blazers.
Mm-hmm.
In a few minutes, we're going to meet a young man. We're going to be introduced to a young man, a fine young man named Scooter Lindley, who's a Blue Blazer. But he doesn't have he is a kid, but then you have... the great Pinky Carruthers, who's a Blue Blazer, but I mean, he's in the compound. He rides a horse. He plays the bass. So I would imagine there are different levels of Blue Blaziness.
Hmm. So now, if Pinky Carruthers plays in the band, does that make him a Hong Kong Cavalier, yet not a member of Team Banzai?
That would be weird.
I know, but you know, in the book, Pinky is identified as a Blue Blazer, not as a Hong Kong Cavalier. But I imagine, a gig's a gig, and he's a good bass player, but he's not officially a Hong Kong Cavalier.
Maybe it's a situation where the Hong Kong Cavaliers are in town, and a Blue Blazer regular with some talent shows up, and he's like, "Hey, you wanna sit in?"
That sounds very Buckaroo-like. I'd go with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he would totally pull just Blue Blazer regulars up on stage to have fun.
Works for me. Works for me. I feel at this point I should point out the state trooper. Did you guys notice that crazy uniform he was wearing?
Yes. That is right out of Plan 9.
Yeah, very much so. And I thought, well, is this some kind of stylized homage to, old 30s, 40s, 50s movies? Because that uniform looks like something from the 30s.
And what does it say on the shoulder, too? There's that kind of yellow patch. I can't really make out what the words are.
Yeah, it says New Jersey State Police, because that, in point of fact, it looks very costumey, but that is a New Jersey State Trooper uniform. That's the actual uniform that they wear. It's very much a throwback to the 1930s. It's got the Sam Brown belt and everything. Huh. And was designed in the 30s by H. Norman Schwarzkopf Sr., the father of General Schwarzkopf of Desert Storm, who formed the New Jersey State Troopers in the early 1930s.
Oh, well done.
That is mind-blowing. I'd like to be a member of the Highway Patrol just for a week, just to get the uniform.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just have the, yeah. You can get a lot of free donuts with that uniform.
Do they still wear that same type of uniform even today? Or
yeah.
Did they? Really?
Yeah. Yeah, if you, because Curtis, you did that. If you Google New Jersey State Trooper, you'll see that exact same uniform.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
It looks like a costume.
Like the bright blue and all that, yeah.
It looks like the most unbelievable police costume uniform you've ever seen. You would laugh at a movie that had that in it.
Yeah, like I said, that was H. Norman Schwarzkopf Sr. And he was late 20s, early 30s. He founded the New Jersey State Troopers, and that was his uniform design. And so it hasn't changed in like over 80 years.
Very cool. Well, that's tradition for you.
One can only hope that they do traffic control via blimps.
Dirigibles.
Dirigibles and yes. Autogyros.
Yes. Talking again about some of the stuff that happens here, we do see the three men in the suits, walking forward. Are they FBI? No, they're from Yoyodyne. And the thing I like here is, if you look at John Gomez, played by Vincent Schiavelli, he's smoking this very weird-looking pipe. And the pipe itself seems to look like the same coral design of some of the ships that the Lectroids have.
I was looking at that. I was wondering about that. To me, it looks like a scorpion. Like he's smoking out of the stinger end. Like he's sucking on the stinger end and the container for the tobacco or whatever is like the scorpion head. But it would make sense to me that it looks like the Lectroid ships.
Yeah. Well, it is a bit weird, and you got that eerie smile, oh, nice night. Yeah.
Well, there's also Schiavelli's hand. It's, if you look, he's holding that pipe. His hand is doing weird things there. And that's I'm guessing Schiavelli is double jointed. Because his thumb looks like an extra index finger.
Oh, weird.
Ooh, yeah.
I think that's also what makes the pipe look so weird, is you can't tell what's the pipe and what's his hand. So, I also seem to recall that, Schiavelli suffered from some kind of a congenital disorder, disease that, might be affecting, like his hand, for example. But regardless, it's a great affectation.
Well, we're going to see other Lectroids sort of do interesting things with their hands. I wonder if there's any relation there.
Yeah, could be. Maybe. I don't know. Tune into further episodes and find out. But we still have about a minute in this one to go.
Yeah, but moving forward in the minutes, we're back now on World Watch 1. And we are graced with the 16-color EGA graphic depiction of a map of New Jersey on one of those monitors. Rawhide is quick to take charge. He's calling for blue blazers in a 10-minute radius. No strike team, though. No disintegrations.
Yeah. I've always liked that line because his tone intonates that Tommy has done this before. We're getting a glimpse of a previous Buckaroo Banzai adventure in which Tommy Well, he shouldn't have called the strike teams. He called strike teams when it wasn't a strike team scenario. So this is the way he says it. No strike teams.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to think that Tommy just is always wants to call on the strike teams. You know what I mean? Hey, our food's a little late here at this diner, isn't it? Yeah, let's call a strike team.
Call a strike team.
I just picture, I want to think that Tommy gleefully just calls out strike teams for anything. Traffic jam, parking ticket, call it a strike team.
And that's when the rug suckers would arrive, right?
Exactly, and the Galachi brothers.
The Galachi brothers, that's right.
Yeah. And who knows who else?
Who's in the bus with them right here? We've got Hal. Ah. Hal sort of running the, what do you call it? I guess radar? That isn't quite right, is it?
Yes. Well, that's the other radar blazer. That's Ed's colleague, Al. He's played by actor Gary Bissig, this other working actor. But the interesting thing about him is that he was in another movie that was kind of related to this one. He was in War Games with Matthew Broderick. He was a deputy.
Ah, okay.
But I kind of think interesting thing about this. So we've got Ed and we've got Al. So that means we've got Al and Ed. And so Al and Ed are doing audio stuff for Buckaroo. I wonder if Earl MacRouche was inspired by Al and Ed's auto sound in Burbank, California. It's I don't know if that's a thing in San Francisco, but yeah, it's a chain of auto sound places in the Southland.
Yeah, if it was a snake, it'd bit you. So I think kudos to you on that one. That seems like such a screenwriter's in joke. If you know, if not Rauch, then possibly Richter or the two of them together over a bottle of wine. Al and Ed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have never known that one. I don't live in Southern California.
Hmm.
But that's a good one.
Yep. And then we kind of jump back. Now we get the quick shot of Buckaroo rescuing Hakita.
I've got questions.
Okay, we've got answers. Yeah. Nice.
Rolling up on a Harley Davidson, how far did Buckaroo have to walk to not be detected? Is this like a 45-minute scene here? He didn't just roll up to the back of the van and then get off his bike. No way.
It was a very, very quiet Harley.
Well, they show him. Do they show him coasting down the hill?
Well, yeah. Is he coasting or is he actually riding it or driving it?
I would say coasting myself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the lights are still on. Hold on.
Well, maybe the battery works, but the engine is shot.
Nah, that's not. Yeah. That's not an '80s bike.
Going on how on all of my appearances on this podcast. I would say yes, indeed, it is coasting.
Just not working when you need it to.
Just going through the motions. That bike is just going through the motions.
Yeah. but what do you think of the second instance of the zapping gag? You know, when Banzai touches Hakita and then zap.
Seems a little rushed, perhaps. It's another one of those scenes that you see in this movie that seems like. It was a rush take, and maybe they had something more elaborate in mind. But we know that this was kind of a chaotic shoot, and you had pressure from executives. So yeah, it seems a little rushed, and you don't quite see that. It looks like they just maybe had a practical effect doing that flash. I didn't see any animated blue lightning.
Hmm. Yeah, would you have felt different if there was the blue lightning?
Of course. You know how I feel about blue lightning.
Yes.
It's one of the trademarks of a great 80s movie.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the moment when he touches him on the shoulder and there's the flash of blue?
Yeah, it almost looks like it's a practical effect. It's just like a little flash.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely gets the point across that Buckaroo's still hot, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, it's just a really quick cut. You imagine that there would have been more of a follow-up in that scene.
Yeah, it does feel a little abrupt, because then it cuts directly to Perfect Tommy, who's putting out the call for all the Blue Blazer regulars.
Yeah. And you get a lot of terminology you know, when the Blue Blazers get called out, you know, there's, it's all the code numbers. Mm-hmm. It just sounds cool. Mm-hmm. Like what's some of the things he says, you know, this is a number 10 call with extra mayonnaise or something like that.
He's like, hold on, I got it. It's a interstate something. Interstate Outward Band 5, coded.
Hmm.
Calling all Blue Blaze irregulars in the Garden State.
Hmm.
If I was, say, 10 years old in 1984, and I was listening on my CB, and I heard that coming through, oh, would I be happy. Buckaroo in trouble? The deuce, you say.
Yeah. Well, we get at the end of these minutes, we do get the glimpse of who is receiving this message. And that's young Scooter Lindley. That's actor Damon Hines. I think we'll talk about him a little bit more in the next episode. But there he is, decked out in his BB hat in a room that is a shrine to all things Buckaroo. We get a Buckaroo poster. We will pull back. I guess we'll see in the next minutes that there's also a Perfect Tommy poster in there. Also a payphone in there.
Well, it is at his father's, is it garage?
Yeah, the gas station.
Yeah, the gas station garage. Mm-hmm. So it could be that's also where the payphone is. Or mm-hmm. maybe his dad just says, hey, you want to make a call? You got to pay for it, Ken.
The Buckaroo poster looks like just literally a picture of the performance from earlier to me.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely taken. Yeah, it's definitely taken from Marty's Arnery. But still, it's a nice touch. You know, the concert poster.
Yep.
A must if you were a kid in the 80s.
With that ends our 5 minutes. We were able to get through the woods and relatively unscathed. And now we're going to be talking about Scooter Lindley and yet another portion of this film.
We end on such a cliffhanger this week.
Yeah.
This is Scooter Lindley. Pew! Nothing.
That's it.
I actually, in watching these minutes, I thought I'd have at least another 30 seconds. It's like, okay, there's Scooter, and good night.
Nope. Yeah, no, that's done. It. But Curtis, thank you very much for taking the time to come on our show and give insights. It was fun.
Indeed.
Insights. It was so fun. I look forward to just listening to the rest of this podcast. You guys were great in 5 minutes of trouble. Do you do any other podcasts out there, the two of you?
Yes. Why,
individually or together?
Yes, we do. The other big podcast that we're doing right now is called 12 Chimes, It's Midnight. And that's the old-time radio drama style podcast that Amy Pavi is putting together. This is a show that will soon be featuring, actually, another one of the scripts that I had a chance to write. And Brett will be in that one as well. That's coming up.
Oh, cool. I'm looking forward to that.
We, in fact, just recently recorded your script, which is a great script. It's worthy of the Twilight Zone. And, 12 Chimes, It's Midnight.
We have 5 minutes of trouble, which we may actually be doing another bonus episode of that one coming up pretty soon. So if you like this type of format and you like Big Trouble Little China, go and listen to that. 5 minutes of trouble.
Shh. It's a top secret. Yes. Nobody talks about the secret.
Why don't you tell our audience, Curtis, a little bit about where they can find you and the stuff you're working on?
Well, we participated recently. That is, Jason and I participated in the Die Hard Minute. We kicked off the series, episodes 1 through 5, and then again at the new year, kicked off the 2018 with some episodes. We were one of the 13 teams. We are still in the middle of doing the Better Off Dead Minute, which is going on a full year. We're getting it, though. We're recording it. I've got the Clue Minute podcast coming up, a podcast where we're going to cover the minute. We're going to cover the movie Clue minute by minute as a whodunit. We're going to follow the clues each minute and try to figure out if the clues match the conclusion they came to in the movie, which I suspect they didn't, but I guess we'll find out.
That's a fun concept.
And other than that, just over here in Iowa taking pictures.
All right. For our listeners, if you can remember to please visit us at 5minutesofbonsai.com. You can also check us out on Facebook at 5minutesofbonsai and Twitter at 5minutesbonsai. We also have a listeners group on Facebook called the 5 Minutes of Bonsai Bunkhouse. So please come check it out. Join today. You may even be a guest on the show just through that. Who knows? And this is a weekly podcast, so please subscribe to us on iTunes so you can get your new episodes every Tuesday. We're also on Stitcher and Google Play. And if you can, please rate us on iTunes. Give us your highest review possible. It helps spread the word about the podcast, and we like it. So thank you. And that's about it. So thank you. Thank you, Curtis. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you, Josh and Brett.
Thank you, Lectroids.
Yeah. And this is World Watch 1 signing off. Tune in next time for another 5 minutes of Bonsai. And remember,
no matter where you go, there you are.